Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Joel Berg. Berg is the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. He served for 8 years in the Clinton administration in senior executive service positions in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He created a number of high-profile initiatives that fought hunger. In order to call the nation's attention to the issues of hunger and poverty, Berg published an important book last fall called All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, published by Seven Stories Press. I'm speaking to Joel Berg by phone from his office in New York City. Joel Berg, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, hunger is an issue that it seems we shouldn't have to be talking about in 21st century America, but let's begin with the fact that you mentioned early on. Talk to us about the fact that so many Americans still don't believe there's even a hunger problem in this country.
Americans have been socialized into believing that the problem of hunger really is the visual picture of a small African child with a distended belly sitting on parched earth, surrounded by flies and Sally Struthers. that's really the American ideal of hunger. And the truth is, because, as I point out in my book, the Federal Nutrition Assistance Safety Net really worked, we've reduced that kind of third world style starvation, but we still have 36 million Americans, including more than 2 million New York State residents, that live in homes that can't afford enough food. So it's not Sudan or North Korean style people starving the street, but it is people choosing between food and rent, people choosing between food and health care, rationing food, skipping meals, and the greatest irony of all, becoming obese because they can't afford the more nutritious, more expensive food. And that's the reality of hunger in America today.
Yeah.
A lot of people, you know, for instance, in the southern tier of New York, don't understand it is a problem, and it's a growing problem there. I was just at a conference in Washington with some people from the food bank from the southern tier of New York, and they were telling me places like Elmira and Binghamton and Ithaca have a serious and growing problem. So it's not just a New York City problem, and certainly not just Africa or Asia problem. It's a real problem in New York.
Yes, indeed, and I hope more people start figuring that out. Now, many people think of the Great Depression as the historical touchstone when hunger and poverty reached its peak. Can compare that to now, though, for us?
Well, we don't have exact numbers because the federal government really didn't measure hunger then, but by all anecdotal accounts, it was far, far worse.
Mm-hmm.
When people
mm-hmm.
say, oh, we're the same as the Depression now, that's ridiculous. Unemployment's still below 10%, although obviously too high. That unemployment was 25, 30%. People were so hungry, they were digging up for roots in most public parks, including Central Park. There were lines around, you know, blocks and blocks and blocks at soup kitchens. We still, unfortunately, have two similar lines today. But as I point out in the book, from at least anecdotal reports, and even before the Depression, with the onset of the Industrial Revolution, when kids would have one or two meals at most a day and then go work in the mines or go then work in a garment factory, so things are actually somewhat better now.
Mm-hmm.
They're not nearly where we need to be, but I point this out because if people don't understand we've made progress, they'll think progress is impossible, that hunger is just a natural part of the human environment. But when they understand that it's human actions, political actions, economic actions by human beings that determine whether we have a lot of hunger, a little hunger, or in fact, as in Northern Europe, virtually no hunger, they'll understand that there's a lot more we can do today.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk to us about how hunger is measured nowadays. You argue that it's tied to political ideology.
It is. Under the Clinton administration, in which I proudly served, we developed a new mechanism called the Community Food Security mechanism, and that we really measured how much household food insecurity there was. And we used that horribly wonkish term, food insecurity, because it really does denote the American problem. It's not widespread starvation. It is people rationing, people juggling. And we had two categories. We had food insecurity, and then the most severe form of food insecurity we called hunger, and that was more similar to the third world style conditions. There still are millions of Americans who do actually go significant periods of time without food, but the Bush administration actually stopped using the word hunger. I can now talk about the Bush administration in the past tense.
Indeed.
I won't be losing a lot of sleep over doing that. So they stopped calling it hunger and started calling it very low food insecurity. very low food security. And I actually collect in my free time, this is the kind of fun guy I am, pop culture references to the word hunger or hungry. It's about a foot high. And so it shows you in the New York Times and the fancy dining section, if, you know, you're a half hour late on your reservation, you're really hungry. Serena Williams want to win a tennis match, or Tiger wants to win a golf match. They're hungry for a win. An executive's hungry for a new assignment. So it is a glaring irony to me that for all the rest of us in society, if we're even vaguely have an appetite, or we have some other desire in our life, we use the word hungry freely, and yet conservatives and the Bush administration argued that not everyone measured by the government who didn't have food for long periods of time was hungry, and some conservatives argue today that not everyone going to a soup kitchen or food pantry is hungry. It's really a preposterous double standard.
Yeah,
the Bush administration also stopped releasing this information before each November's election. The Clinton administration released this data in October, and miraculously under the Bush folks, it started coming out in November after each election. I think it's just coincidental that hunger went up each year Bush was president.
Yeah, right. You also mentioned there have to be more hungry people than we can even fathom, because you say that homeless people aren't even counted.
Yeah, when Americans think of the hungry, to use that term, and I hate it in the same way the homeless sort of denotes this nameless, faceless mass. Americans tend to equate, when they think of domestic hunger at all, but they think of sort of the homeless person on the street begging for change. And the homeless person on the street panhandling is a small subsection of the people who are homeless. Most do not, panhandle. And the people on the street are a small subsection of those homeless. In New York City last year, there are 100,000 separate people who spent at least one night in a homeless shelter, 100,000 separate people. But people don't understand, the homeless are a very small, small subsection. Those people are hungry, less than 10%. In New York City last year, over 1.3 million New Yorkers were forced to use pantries and kitchens. Statewide, that number is more than 2 million people. So the people who are homeless are really a very small amount of the hunger problem. It's not people who are homeless. It's people who are poor and just don't earn enough to feed their families.
Oh, and it's a disgrace that this is happening in this day and age. So let's talk about the Food Stamp Act, which I believe passed around 1977. How did that help? The WIC program, school lunches, and so on?
Well, there was a pilot program started under President Kennedy, reviving a pilot program on the New Deal, but it was really over the late 60s and early 70s that the modern nutrition assistance safety net was born and dramatically expanded. And it had a profound impact. And I know it's shocking to tell people that government programs worked. Government programs demonstrably, concretely worked. Before they were in existence, we still had grander pockets of third-world-style malnutrition. Doctors went down to places like the Mississippi Delta and found kids with, the protruding stomach from malnutrition like you would see today in other parts of the world. 10 years later, after we had a modern food stamps program, a modern women's, infants, and children program, WIC program, after we expanded school meals, doctors went down to the same places and found that those conditions basically failed to exist. It's only because we've gone backwards. We sold the country on really the con job that underfunded, undercoordinated charities run by volunteers can somehow solve a major problem impacting 36 million Americans. It's only since the 80s that this country's been sold on that ideology that we've had this dramatic increase in hunger again and the modern plague of homelessness.
And you mentioned that the Food Stamp Act helped to end starvation, but not many of the other aspects of why people are hungry, which is what you were just touching on, correct?
Absolutely. Nutrition Safety Net did a remarkable job of reducing hunger. And when the federal government focused on poverty, it did dramatically reduce poverty. It is accepted today, even among liberals, that the war on poverty, the Great Society, was an utter failure. And the truth is, that's a con job, too. Between 1960 and 1973, the poverty rate in America was cut in half. 16 million Americans moved out of poverty and into the middle class. Not all of it was the Great Society programs. Some of it was a booming economy, but a lot of that was impacted by positive economic and governmental policies. So the truth is that when Congress and the president focused on reducing poverty, they did it. When they focused on reducing hunger, they did it. Unfortunately, we've slowed down on the hunger side and virtually ignored the poverty side, and that's why over the last few decades, collectively, since the Reagan era, we've had a spike in poverty. It went down a bit under the Clinton administration, which I served. But even if we end hunger, as long as we have the soaring poverty, we'll just have to spend a lot more money on federal nutrition assistance programs.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm certainly for that in the interim, but the best long-term approach to dealing with this problem is go back to a time when people working full-time and playing by the rules could earn enough to feed their families. I challenge conservatives who are against food stamps, okay, you're against food stamps, then support our call to dramatically increase the minimum wage. That would not cost a penny of government funding, and that would dramatically reduce hunger in America.
I agree with you on that one. Well, let's talk about the food stamp challenge.
You must be a socialist. I mean, I laugh. I am a committed capitalist. My grandparents came here from countries where there was no opportunity and where they would have been slaughtered and built a better life for their children and particularly their grandchildren through incredibly hard work.
Mm-hmm.
But we've lost that today. We have crony capitalism where it's not how hard to work, it's who you know. And this idea that the president is proposing marginally restoring previous levels of taxation on the rich, they would still be lower than before Reagan. They would still be lower for the ultra-rich before Reagan. That people are saying that's socialism. That is preposterous.
Oh, it is. Oh, it is.
Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican hero, a John McCain hero, you know, proposed more progressive taxation and making sure we didn't have this, you know, oligarchy and plutocracy in America. It's not socialism. It's mainstream American idea that people who got to be wealthiest, shipping goods over government-paved roads, getting workforces from public schools, often getting huge tax subsidies for their businesses, should pay a little more regular taxes the way the rest of us do.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, not to skip around, but this is a New York State program. We've been pretty critical of Governor Patterson for consistently refusing to have even a discussion of restoring previous levels of taxation on the richest in this society. And he's restored some funding to pantries and kitchens, but not as much as he's got. And so when we have these sort of very vague discussions of spending and taxes, people don't know what these cuts mean. They don't know what the taxes mean. I'll tell you what it means. If we did what the assemblies proposed and just marginally restore taxation on the wealthiest in New York, millionaires, we wouldn't have to cut funding to soup kitchens and food pantries.
I don't understand the fear of the word socialism anyway. I lived in the Netherlands for several years, and those countries are performing beautifully in regard to taking care of their populations. So that fear of that word socialism makes no sense to me.
Well, I got a letter to the editor in Today's Times or Times a few days ago, and it said, you know, I ride over government paved roads. I guess you could call that socialist. We went to government public schools. I guess you could call that socialist. So I don't know why anyone is freaked out over the idea of medicine being run a little more by government, which works very effectively in Canada and other places. So, you know, I do believe in the profit incentive. I do believe that people who work harder should be rewarded more. So I'm not a socialist. I am a capitalist, but I do think we need a basic safety net. And as you point out, you know, the countries in Northern Europe tax their wealthiest more. In fact, speeding tickets in, I think, Finland are actually proportional to income. There's a famous case of a famous hockey star getting the equivalent of like a $100,000 speeding ticket. And you know what they do with the money? They make sure their people don't starve. That makes a lot of sense to me.
That's right. I've heard about that, too, in Norway. Now, let's talk about that food stamp challenge, which you yourself participated in.
Yes.
In 2007, I believe. Tell us what that felt like and how you fared.
I lived for a week on the amount of money you could get to buy food through the food stamps program, which 2 years ago was $28.30 a week.
In New York City, right? Yeah.
Yeah, in New York City, be a little less, you know, in the Ithaca area. So that's a little more than a dollar per meal. And with a lot of help at home, shopping and cooking from scratch, my partner taking hours to prepare each meal sometimes, I could barely get by. But even with all that help, I couldn't afford a single beverage. I couldn't afford anything organic My diet was really skewed for the week. And one thing that really popped into my mind that I hadn't really focused on before, that in a white-collar workplace, and I run a nonprofit, so I guess you could call me white-collar, and I go to a lot of professional meetings, there are often breakfast meetings with free food, lunch meetings with free food, cocktail receptions where the shrimp cocktail is almost as plentiful as the actual cocktail where we get in for free. And just as Hollywood stars and starlets get these infamous swag bags at the Academy Awards, tens of thousands of dollars worth of stuff going to the people need it least, in our society, the people who need food least get it free all the time. In New York City, Mayor Bloomberg insisted that the new government-subsidized Yankee Stadium have a special luxury skybox for VIP guests of the mayor, and insisted that everyone who goes to that luxury skybox get free food paid for by the Yankees. And yet, he has been adamant in making it absurdly, ridiculously difficult for low-income people to get food stamps. So, and by the way, I repriced the food stamps challenge today. I could not even do it again today. It would just be too hard for me to do it, given the increase in the food prices. So, you know, if I was really low income and had to, I guess I could, you know, I'd make do somehow and go to pantries and kitchens and take that humiliating step. But as hard as it was 2 years ago, given the soaring food prices, it'd be even more difficult today. And you try going a week without a beverage other than milk. Other than tap water, never being able to change the taste on your palate, being on a subway platform and wanting a drink and there's a vendor there and you can't buy it, and by the way, never being able to buy something at even a fast food restaurant, not being able to get a slice of pizza under food stamps rules. If it's warm or hot, you can't buy it because the federal government says that's a luxury.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joel Berg. He's the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and author of a very important new book called All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America. Joel, let's talk about the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. What kind of results did we get from that?
Mixed results. And this is perhaps the most nuanced chapter of my book. And sometimes it's a little hard to talk about nuance. I basically say that both the left and the right were wrong in predicting what welfare reform would do immediately. And I did work for President Clinton, and I think he actually made the right decision in signing the bill, although it was a close call, and many of my colleagues disagree with me. The massive increase in poverty predicted by the left didn't happen, but the massive move towards permanent independence predicted by the right didn't happen. So I basically say in the 90s, when the economy was really strong, and I obviously think Clinton can take a lot of share of the credit for that, people were moving off the rolls and people were moving into work. Not all of it was living wage work, but they were moving into work, and the Clinton administration in some states were working on getting people food stamps or income tax credits, other work support. Although the people who were kicked off the rolls were sort of falling deeper into poverty. So it was this bifurcated sense that the people doing better were doing better, the people doing worse were doing a lot worse. So it was a mixed bag in the 90s, and I basically say since 2000 it's gone from a mixed bag to a total disaster. The welfare rolls have continued to plummet, even as jobs further evaporate, and they are couched and proclaimed by elected officials such as Governor Pataki or Mayor Bloomberg, oh, we're moving everyone off the rolls into jobs. It's just not true. People aren't moving into jobs. They're moving into the street. And judging the success of welfare reform solely by how many people left the rolls, it's sort of like judging the success of a hospital solely by how many people left it without differentiating between how many people left it cured, how many people left it dead, versus how many people left it equally sick. And so I think we need to reform welfare reform to once again not only focus on reducing the rolls, but focus on reducing poverty and really looking at the well-being of the children of the families on the program. There is sort of a double standard that for yuppies, we assume that child care and raising your children is a vital, vital job. You know, we assume that, you know, particularly women, not to be sexist, but that's sort of the societal assumption, no matter how well you're doing in life, you're going to leave work for a time period to raise your kids, and that is seen as virtuous. For poor people, if they want to, you know, not work outside the home and raise their children, oh my God, they're the most irresponsible women ever. And we have a tremendous double standard that for everyone else, we say education, education, education. That is the key of upward mobility. And yet the recent new welfare laws have made it more difficult for people on welfare to get a college education. That is, forget ideology, that's ridiculously counterproductive. If we all agree that the best long-term solution is to help people move towards long-term economic independence, we should all agree that people need access to quality, affordable education. And that's why I am so thrilled that our new president is changing the former priorities on its head. I got so mad when even moderate, supposed liberals who are really moderate to right, such as the Washington Post editorial board, criticized the Obama recovery plan for including Pell Grants to help low-income people go to college and
Yes.
That's not economic stimulus. That's preposterous. First of all, any editorial writer who could write that obviously never had to worry about their kids affording college. Second of all, of course, higher education for low-income people is going to make us more competitive. And so I must say the only good news we've had is we have the first president in U.S. history who grew up in a family that received food stamps. He gets it. His stimulus bill provided the most significant infusion of anti-hunger funding in decades. His budget bill provides a very significant additional funding. When right-wingers criticize these plans as being horrible waste of money, that's not what it is. They're upset because it's money for poor people and money for people who didn't contribute to their campaigns. That's what's upsetting the conservatives.
It is absolutely shameful. It really is. Now, let's talk about some of your ideas in regard to ending most hunger in this country. President Obama says he wants to end it by 2015, and you came up with some ideas in your book. Tell us about it.
Well, first of all, we need a focus on living wage jobs. We need to get companies to voluntarily pay their workers more. So, again, I'm a capitalist. I think people should even maybe be rich and have a vacation home. But instead of having seven vacation homes and paying your workers so little they can't afford to feed their families, maybe you can only have five vacation homes and pay the cafeteria workers in your corporation enough to feed their families. And if they don't voluntarily do it, let's raise the minimum wage. Two, we need to reform the Federal Nutrition Assistance Safety Net. There are over a dozen competing programs. Low-income people have to apply to each of them, sometimes waiting 1 or 2 or 3 days. We should combine them all, reduce bureaucracy, which conservatives should like, but increase the funding for benefits, which progressives should like. Three, we should really focus on child nutrition and move to universal in-classroom school breakfasts, so it's a lot easier for low-income and all kids to get free school breakfasts. We need to promote community food security, like community gardens and farmers markets. But I do take Michael Pollan and Alice Waters and other sort of foodies to task in my book for their class bias, to say those are going to replace food stamps, as some foodies have said, or to say that increasing food prices are a good thing is insane. So we need community food security, but in the context of this broader social reform. And lastly, we need a serious attempt to slash poverty again. Do all those things, even most of those things, and you can reach the president's goal of ending child hunger in America in just a few years as a down payment on ending all hunger in America.
And I liked your idea of having just one universal application, because so many people have to run through rings to even apply for some of these programs now.
It is crazy. In New York State, food stamps are pegged at 130% of the poverty line. In other words, you can make poverty wages plus 30%. WIC is 185% of the poverty line. Free school meals are 130% of the poverty line. Reduced price meals are 185% of the poverty line, and so on and so on. There are different applications for all these. You often have to go to a different government office, spending 1 or 2 or 3 days. 90% of the information you're giving is identical on all these applications. And again, if you're a conservative and you want people to be working, and even if you're a moderate, such as myself, and want people to be working instead of spending their time at government offices, shouldn't you reduce this bureaucracy, stop punishing poor people for the supposed poor of being poor, and make it easier to get their benefits so they can do things we all think they should do, work, look for work, and raise their children.
And I would think a one universal application would also help with wasteful bureaucracy, you know? I mean, there's so much waste. in just people trying to tap into these programs, because there's different rules in different places. So
absolutely, and we can refocus those resources better if we didn't have at the federal, state, and county levels different offices, different application forms, different processing systems for each of those more than a dozen federal nutrition assistance programs.
Mm-hmm. Do you still want to call it the American Family Food Opportunity and Responsibility? That was the name that you had come up with for this new program.
Yeah, my colleague Tom Friedman came up with that. I had the idea of buying the programs, and he said, boy, he's a political consultant. No one's going to remember any of that. So now that acronym spells AFFORD. So I think that's a great name.
I thought it was, too. Now, you argue that we can end all food insecurity in America for the cost of 3 months of what we're spending in Iraq.
Yes.
How are we going to implement these good ideas? I mean, there's got to be a will.
Well, we need people to contact their elected officials. We've been so conned into America into thinking that all we can do is a little extra charity. Trying to end hunger with just a few extra canned food drives is like trying to fill the Grand Canyon with a teaspoon. It cannot and will not work. And so, yes, we want more people to donate cans. Even more importantly, they should donate money so food banks can buy far more cans because they buy wholesale. Even more importantly than that, people should contact their elected officials. They should contact Senator Schumer, who's been extraordinarily supportive, and thank him and urge him to do more. Contact Senator Gillibrand, who's was somewhat helpful in the House and is sort of a bit of a question mark now that she's in the Senate.
Urge
them to be real leaders on these issues, as well as congresspeople. I know Maurice Hinchey from your neck of the woods has really been a leader on these issues, so you're fortunate to have that leadership, but you should still make sure people hear from you. Let Governor Patterson hears from folks and says, for goodness sakes, can you restore previous levels of taxation on millionaires who, by the way, did not leave the state when they had that higher level, and use that funding to make sure we don't have to close pantries and kitchens? That's just common sense.
Yeah. Now, what does your Coalition Against Hunger actually do? Is it an advocacy organization, or
are they really
on the streets? Okay.
We do a number of things. We are an umbrella group for the 1,200 soup kitchens and food pantries in New York City and the more than 1.3 million people they serve. So we do a number of things. We certainly do advocacy. We do communications work. We do research. But we also help these agencies get food from small farmers and people on food stamps to get food from small farmers, some of which are the Finger Lakes region, in your listenership area. We help people get food stamps. We provide AmeriCorps National Service participants. Some of your listeners may know that's sort of a domestic Peace Corps. We provide that to these agencies. We help them get computers and use computers. We help recruit volunteers for them. So we're pretty small. We only have 8 full-time employees, but we're scrappy, and we use our funds very effectively. So we get that done for every year for a budget of just a little over $1 million a year.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, we only have about a minute left. You argue that low-income people need to be encouraged to speak for themselves. How do you do that?
Well, we just had a conference in Washington this week, and we actually recruited people from pantries and kitchens to come down with us to the conference and to go lobby their elected officials. No social movement in history has been won by one people on behalf of another. If the civil rights movement was just up to white people or the women's rights movement was just up to men, I'm not sure we would have had this progress. So I believe firmly we have to recruit and empower low-income people to be in the front lines of the anti-hunger movement if we're going to get real serious results.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any kind of contact information that people can get in touch with you and get involved?
Sure. They can go either, my website, joelberg.net, joelberg.net, for information about the book and my speaking appearances and how to get one. Or you can go to the New York City Coalition Against Hunger at www.nyccah.org.
Well, Joel Berg, thank you so much for joining us, and I really highly recommend your book. I hope people will go out and get it. It's called All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, and it was published by Seven Stories Press. Joel Berg, thank you so much, and good luck.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.